WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Jan Wong, used to be a true believer. In the days when China was radical chic, as she puts it, she believed the glorious things she heard about the revolution. As a Chinese-Canadian teenager in Montreal, the daughter of a prosperous restaurant owner, she wanted to experience the harmony of the Cultural Revolution and live in the workers' paradise she believed Mao was creating. In 1972, at the age of 19, she left Montreal to study at Beijing University. She stayed for the better part of 8 years. When disillusionment finally overtook her, she returned home, went to journalism school, and became a reporter. In 1988, she returned to China, this time to cover the country for the Toronto Globe and Mail. She stayed for 6 years and won several journalism awards, including the George Polk Award. Jan Wong has written a new memoir called Red China Blues, My Long March from Mao to Now. I asked her to explain why she first went to China.
China, to me, was like a utopia. It was a mysterious country far away. It was the home of my ancestors. And I thought that they were the first country in world history to try to do the right thing, to try to make people equal, to end oppression and end exploitation. And so I thought of it as this almost like a Disneyland, something where nothing would go wrong.
You arrived in China in the middle of the Cultural Revolution. What was your introduction to the Cultural Revolution?
Well, I remember going into the hotel room, and I just felt, this is such a weird place. I mean, to have a hotel lobby covered with slogans. And I also remember seeing lots of soldiers on the street. And having come from an era of protest against war, I was quite taken aback by so much militarism. But I also felt, this is a wonderful country because the women aren't wearing makeup. There's no pantyhose. I don't even see a wedding ring. And as a budding feminist, I was just beginning to become a feminist in those days. I thought, this is terrific.
And what was your status as one of the first two students from the Western world allowed to study in China since the Cultural Revolution?
Well, we were in a very special position. The other girl, I call her a girl because we were 19, was an American Chinese. Her name was Erica. And she and I were treated, I say in the book, we were treated like revolutionary royalty. And it was ironic because they were so good to us. They gave us our own cook just for the two of us. They opened up a deserted dormitory. You see, the schools had been closed mostly. And they had a deserted dormitory. They moved in an entire class of Chinese females to be our friends. And we had our own teachers. And we had our own typist who would do our vocabulary lists for us. And the ironic thing, of course, is that we didn't want privilege. We didn't want to be different. We wanted to be just like the Chinese. And so we fought to do physical labor. At times, we even cried so that we could join in.
And you thought that that would be good for you, that it would be humbling, it would take away your kind of inherent bourgeoisism?
Well, I had read Mao. I had read a little bit of Mao, and Mao had said, you know, your class background really determines the way you think. And I had come from a very nice middle-class background. My father owned restaurants. He had actually made his first million by the time he was 40, only he never told us. And I thought that I really needed to reform my thinking. If I was going to be of any use to this world, if I was going to do good in this world, I had to get rid of my bourgeois thinking and think like the proletariat. And Mao had said that if you do a lot of physical labor and understand how things are created, and if you know how hard it is to do physical labor, you will change. And I used to do all this stuff and kill myself. I would work so hard that my hands would shake at the end of the day and I couldn't even hold chopsticks to eat dinner. I'd be so exhausted. But I would stop sometimes and think, well, how's my mind doing? And really, you know, all I did was dream about fresh peach pie and French fries. And so I don't think I was making any progress.
Let's talk a little bit about what your education in China was like. You had one teacher who you called Fu the Enforcer.
Yes, that's right. The education was very strange. It was the middle of the Cultural Revolution. I was trying to learn Chinese, and I had what you might think were ideal conditions. I was in a completely Chinese environment. I had my own teacher, and my teacher didn't speak English. But while that was very good, it was also very tough. It was total immersion, not just language-wise, but culturally. And I call her Foo the Enforcer because she was a hardline party member. And she would scold me for all kinds of things. And she also had this tremendous prejudice against me because she knew my father was a capitalist restaurant owner. And so, for instance, during lessons, she would say, well, we won't do this story because it's about a blood-sucking restaurant owner and we don't want to hurt your feelings. So Erica would get that chapter. Erica's father was a professor. And she would tell me things like, oh, her parents love her more because they're not as corrupt as your parents. Your parents are the bourgeoisie. Her parents are sort of bourgeois intellectuals, but they don't exploit anybody. So they love her more. And I would feel kind of hurt and devastated. And I should also say there were no dictionaries. I had to learn Chinese without a dictionary because they had all been trashed during the Cultural Revolution. And so it was really hard trying to understand things. And my teacher was so out of touch with the outside world that she didn't realize that other languages had verbs. And I remember one lesson when she was trying to explain this concept to me, and finally it dawned on me, she's telling me what a verb is. And I said, you know, we have verbs in English.
What was your social life like?
Ah, the social life during the Cultural Revolution. Well, it was almost non-existent. Erica was the only person I could speak English to in that time, except for a Swedish diplomat whose phone number had been left behind with me. For a group of Americans, American Chinese who were touring China, had felt pity for me when I suddenly was told I could stay behind and study, and I didn't know anybody. So they gave me this guy's phone number. I called him up, and I saw him occasionally, and we had this sort of very innocent relationship. We liked each other, but we had never even held hands, for instance. So, but the Chinese were really upset because he was a diplomat. And in those days, diplomats were considered to be spies. And I'm sure that some were. But as far as I know, he wasn't. He was just a Sinology student who got a temporary posting in Beijing. So we got into all kinds of trouble. And to make this very long story short, I was told not to see him anymore. I thought about it, and I decided I really wanted to be Chinese and to do the right thing and to be like them, and they must know what they're doing, and maybe he is a spy. I mean, who knew? So I broke off with him, and then I bumped into him, I guess several months later, accidentally at somebody else's place, not realizing that we were under surveillance, that we were being watched all the time. And soon after that, I think a week later, they tried to expel me from the university. I was told simply that my studies were over. And the greatest, probably this for me was a real turning point in China when I stopped becoming a true believer. They told me that I had always asked to leave in February. And my roommate and all my friends, all the Chinese friends, my teacher, the administrators in charge, was all insisted that I had asked to leave in February. And of course, I hadn't. I had expected to study until the summer. And that was a real eye-opener for me. But the funniest thing was, so I sold all my clothes. It's a secondhand shop. I sold my bike. I sold my desk lamp. And I called my parents and I said, look, I'm getting kicked out. You know, I have to come home. And they got all upset and they pulled strings in Ottawa at the Chinese embassy in Ottawa. And they managed to get me reinstated. So the funniest thing was, all of a sudden, the administrator came to me and said, okay, you can stay. And you were always supposed to stay. And then everybody else fell into line, and they all pretended it had never happened. And if it weren't for Erica, and if it weren't for the fact that I had no more clothes and my bike wasn't there anymore, I would have thought I had simply been hallucinating. And that, to me, really showed me what China was like, that people can say anything in complete seriousness, and they don't mean it. They just have to lie.
Of course, the big question is, why did you want to stay? First, this is a country that was anxious to get rid of you because you were seeing somebody who was a friend of yours. The rules were really quite rigid. Weren't you getting wise to the system by then? Why did you still want to stay?
I was getting wise to the system, but Mao always had an answer. He would say, well, we're in the stage of socialism. There's still class struggle left. That's why there's bad things. So I could understand why there were glitches and why things would go wrong. That was all explained away. Why did I want to stay? Well, I felt it was such an unusual opportunity to see and live in China. Nobody else had that opportunity. And I felt it was important to do that and to see it. And I also wanted myself to change, and I thought this was the way for me to change, is to be in this kind of socialist boot camp. And I thought it was good for me and maybe good for the world if I went and suffered a little.
My guest is journalist Jan Wong. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Jan Wong. Her new memoir is called Red China Blues, My Long March from Mao to Now. You twice went so far as to report other people to the authorities. You informed on a Chinese student who wanted to go to America and informed on parents who wanted to send their daughter to America to study. What made you think that that would be the right thing to do?
Well, it was the context of the times when I was trying very hard to do the right thing. And I, of course, as a Westerner, I felt, you know, this is snitching. Should I do this? But I was also trying to put myself in the Chinese mindset and trying to do the right thing. They would want to save this person. And I had read Mao, and he had said, well, for the enemy, of course, you're merciless. But for one of the people, you try to save them and reform them with gentle criticism. And I thought that the student would be reformed through criticism. She would be saved. I thought it was appalling that she wanted to go to the West, because I thought of China as sort of a worker's paradise. And when she started asking me, I didn't know her very well, and she didn't know me, because had she known me, she would never have asked me. She would have realized I was a complete fanatic. But she approached me and she said, tell me about what it's like in the West. And, you know, I had been in China almost a full year. Actually, I'd been in China a year by then. And nobody had asked me about the West. Nobody talked about the color televisions and the refrigerators because it was an almost pornographic topic. To talk about the decadence of the West was a no-no. It was a taboo. And she wanted to talk about it, and I felt very uncomfortable. And I said, it's a capitalist country, you know. And she said, yes, I know, and I want to go. So I thought about it. Erica and I were both there, and we both discussed it, and we thought, well, we should report it because that's what we're supposed to do. And also we wanted to save her. And, you know, it wasn't a big moral decision at the time because I didn't think anything bad would happen to her. And because we weren't told what was happening many times. So I never knew what happened to her. And it was only when I started to write this book that I went back and looked at my diaries. And this is in the 90s when I'm a foreign correspondent in China. I looked at my diaries. I saw what I had done. I had completely forgotten. And I was appalled. And I went back and I found my classmates. And I said, whatever, do you remember this incident? And they did. And I said, well, what happened to her? And they said, well, she was hauled before the entire class and she was denounced. And then she was expelled from school, which was a horrible thing to have happened to you in those days because it was such a privilege to go to university. So when I write about it in the book, of course I hesitated because I don't want people to think I'm a terrible person, but I did do those things. I did make mistakes. And why I think it's important is because I realized that that was such a part of Chinese culture. My roommates were snitching on me. People were reporting on me. The reason I was almost expelled for seeing this Swedish person is somebody reported on me. And I wanted to show what an integral part of Chinese society that was. And later when I was a correspondent and after the Tiananmen massacre, the Chinese set up a hotline, what I call a snitch hotline. And people were supposed to report any of their friends or colleagues or relatives who had gone to demonstrate in the square. And I remember as a correspondent being just so delighted that people were not calling in. People, the only people that would call in would say, I want to report a mass murderer and his name is Deng Xiaoping. But people were no longer turning in their colleagues and their friends. And to me, this was a wonderful step forward in Chinese history.
A month after your graduation, the Cultural Revolution ended, and everybody made a big ideological switch. What happened?
Well, Mao had died, and his widow was suddenly arrested. And she was head of a faction that later was called the Gang of Four. They were very radical. And I was really shocked because everybody was ecstatic that she had been overthrown. And I just began to realize I didn't understand the first thing about China.
You must have felt like a real sucker. You know, you're a Chinese Canadian who goes to China during the Cultural Revolution. You become the most fanatic in supporting the Cultural Revolution and so on. And then suddenly the Cultural Revolution's over. Everybody changes ideologies. And what does that say about the time that you spent in China and everything that you believed and supported, all the sacrifices you made? Did you feel like a sucker?
Yes, I felt really stupid, and I knew I couldn't leave China at that point. I had to stay. I had to understand this country and how I had been so duped. But I didn't feel like I had wasted my time, because I might have been two steps behind the Chinese, but there was a point earlier for them when they also believed, when they also, you know, ate it up and did everything they were told and thought maybe they could really reform their minds too. I was just several steps behind them. And when they stopped believing, I didn't realize they had stopped believing. So it was valuable for me to have gone through that process, to have snitched on someone, to understand how they could do it. For later, I could understand that they weren't evil people who had snitched. They were just ordinary people who had been caught up in this tremendous brainwashing and tremendous control of people.
When did you leave?
I left in 1980, that first time. And I came back to North America. I went to school, and I went to journalism school, and then I became a reporter.
And you went back to China in the late 80s, early 90s?
Yes, I went back in 1988 for the Globe and Mail as the Beijing correspondent.
I like the way you say in your book that you switched from being a true believer to an objective observer. It must have been very interesting to return to China after having been a true believer there.
Well, sometimes I felt a bit of nostalgia for the old days, even knowing that there were so many problems. When I first went back in 1988, I was depressed. I looked around me, and you have to remember, this is the kid who went and thought the Mao suit was beautiful. So then I go in 1988, and the women have permed their hair. They're now pulling out their eyebrows and replacing them with these shiny tattoos. I was depressed. And even the young men were getting perms. And everybody wanted to be taller, so the women were wearing high heels. Even the men were wearing high heels. These young toughs would swagger about the street corners playing pool, wearing stacked heels. And even peasant women in the fields, I would see them hauling these, you know, cartloads of grain, and they would be wearing high heels. It was very depressing because everybody seemed to want to ape foreigners. They wanted to have lighter skin. They wanted to be taller. They wanted to have these round eyes. They would get these operations where they would slit their eyelids and so stitch them up and make an extra fold. And because double fold eyelids, as they call them, are sort of Western. And I found that very depressing after all that the Chinese had gone through.
You covered Tiananmen Square for your newspaper. And you write that you couldn't decide who was more foolish, the gerontocracy or the students who were drunk with their newfound celebrity. I think, you know, in America, the story has mostly been covered as the good guys, the students, versus the bad guys, the government. You saw it differently.
Yes, well, it is very tempting to write a David and Goliath story, or to write good guys versus bad guys. It is tempting, and I think I'd like to blame my brothers in the electronic media for that. The television cameras, they need a simple story, and the students could play right into that with their, you know, they were photogenic, they had the red silk flags. I think it was a complicated story, and I don't think I did particularly well reporting that either. I mean, it was very tempting. Your editors just want a simple, dramatic story. But the students were very irritating. For one thing, this hunger strike was not really a hunger strike. I found people with food in their packs, and they thought nothing of, like, having yogurt, because that wasn't a solid food, so it was okay to have yogurt. I found kids who were hunger striking in shifts. They would, like, miss a meal, go back to campus, eat, come back, miss another meal. And they were sort of obnoxious because they set up a mini bureaucracy in the square with their own government and their own passes, and we were issued passes. The journalists were issued passes, and we had to go through 18 checkpoints to get to, like, an important student leader. So they were really aping their own government. And, of course, they had no other models. You can hardly blame them, but it wasn't that pleasant. They weren't that nice, but it was all right. They didn't deserve to die, for sure.
But you thought they made a lot of mistakes.
Yes, but they're kids, you know. And so I as a student who used to sit in my university chancellor's office, I could forgive them for making mistakes.
Now, you got married the first time that you were in China while you were still a student there.
Yes.
How did you meet your husband?
Well, we actually met at a party, not a communist party, I like to say. He is an American draft dodger, and as far as I know, the only American draft dodger who decided to go to China instead of Canada. You know, most of them went to Canada. And he had been working there for a Chinese propaganda magazine as a translator, because foreigners were not allowed to do anything except language-related work. And I remember seeing him the first time. He was wearing a Mao suit, a thick padded Mao suit. It was wintertime, and a Mao cap over his head and Chinese glasses. And I thought he was Chinese. He's not, of course. He's actually a Jewish New Yorker. But I remember talking to him for the first 10 minutes in Chinese. He's fluent. He has no accent. He speaks wonderful Chinese. And only later, when somebody else came over and joined us and he spoke, you know, New York English, did I realize that he wasn't a foreigner. Sounds kind of stupid, doesn't it?
No, but it's interesting that, I mean, the marriage lasted.
Yes, and we're sometimes astonished ourselves because, but we were both raving Maoists, and then luckily we were both there when Mao died and we saw what happened. So we went through that change together. And then we both came back and went to school, and we sort of become sort of middle-aged, sort of materialists together. Of course, he doesn't really like buying sofas and home decorating, but what I mean is we've traveled the same political journey together, and so we're still together, and it's going to be almost 20 years this fall.
Well, Jan Wong, I want to thank you very much for telling us a little bit about your adventures in China. Thank you for talking with us.
Thank you.
Jian Wang's new memoir is called Red China Blues, My Long March from Mao to Now. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.